This is the Six Gun Justice Podcast with Wordslingers Paul Bishop and Richard Brosh.
Howdy, and welcome to the latest action-packed episode of the Six Gun Justice Podcast, where we celebrate the blazing six-gun action of the Western genre in books, movies, TV, and any other media at home on the range. I'm Richard Prosh, and next to me, sporting a Hawaiian tan from trying to round up them doggies on a surfboard instead of a horse, is my co-host Paul Bishop. How are you, pal? Did you have any luck with the surfboard roundup?
Well, it's certainly not as easy as it looks, but neither is it as far-fetched as it sounds.
Really?
Yeah, we think of cowboys as sort of unique to the Wild West, but Hawaii has had cowboys, or paniolo as they are called, since 1793. At that time, Captain Vancouver of the British Royal Navy was dashing about on the HMS Discovery, mapping the coast of North America and ensuring the sun never set on the British Empire. Apparently, God didn't trust Englishmen in the dark. Then, stopping in Alta California, he demanded fealty to Britain from the Spanish there, and he accepts this herd of Texas Longhorns, which he curiously corrals below decks before realizing he had no idea what he was going to do with this valuable cargo. So he's off there sailing around with all these bullocks, as they were called, in the belly of his ship, and inspiration strikes. And he dumps the whole tiny herd off on the Hawaiian Islands and made out that they were a very special gift for the original King Kamehameha.
It sounds like you've been doing your research.
I have.
And this pertains to cowboys. How?
I'm getting there. So King Kamehameha thought those 10 original longhorns were the most magnificent gift he'd ever received, and he forbade the killing of his cattle. Well, by 1830, this was a big problem because by that time, nearly 20,000 bullocks were roaming the main island alone, pillaging gardens, hiding in the forests and ravines, and they also posed a serious threat to the locals as these longhorns were the same breed of cattle that wranglers in Alta California would sometimes pit against grizzly bears for sport. So, bullock hunters, carrying muskets, were eventually unleashed to thin the herds. Their technique was to dig carefully camouflaged pits, or sometimes using natural holes created by collapsed lava tubes, to trap the bullocks, as it was much easier to shoot them that way. But there was no hope for any man who fell into the pit already occupied by a pissed-off longhorn. The slaughter continued until King Kamehameha III figured out there was a way to turn the longhorns into a valuable island export. He recruits a dozen or so Spanish vaqueros from California to teach his bullock hunters how to ranch and develop a thriving cattle business. Replacing their rifles with rawhide lassos, the bullock hunters soon began roping cattle on horseback and leading them skillfully down the mountains. These guys were a new breed of Hawaiian who, as I said before, became known as a paniolo, basically Hawaiian for cowboy, and they faced hurdles unthinkable to mainland cowboys. We're talking lava fields, abandoned camouflaged bullock pits, dense forest, massive thorns, and of all things, sharks.
Sharks?
Yeah, sharks, like right out of Jaws, which brings us back to the idea of roundups on surfboards. Okay, I'll grant you the surfboards were trained shipping horses, with which the paniolo drove their cattle into the surf in order to reach the steamships anchored beyond the reef who were doing the export. But along the way, it wasn't unusual for them to encounter sharks who thought steak tartare was on the menu.
Now, I know you didn't come up with all of that info off the top of your head.
Yes, I did.
No, you didn't.
No, okay. And that brings me to the point of this soliloquy. While in Hawaii, I came across a nonfiction book titled Aloha Rodeo by David Woolman and Julian Smith. And these guys have written tons of stuff for magazines like Outside and the various other adventure magazines. They lay out all the history I talked about to put down the groundwork for the true story of three Hawaiian paniolo who in 1903 staged a shock and awe attack on the Cheyenne, Wyoming Frontier Days Rodeo. Considered the big daddy of all rodeos, if you took top honors at the Cheyenne Frontier Days, you were considered to be the best wrangler in the world.
And I was going to say, you still are.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, huh? So Akua Purdy, not Ikea Purdy, he would have been pretty hard to put together, but Akua Purdy, grandson of the legendary bullock hunter Jack Purdy, and two of his dark-skinned paniolo cousins, Jack Lowe and Archie Kawaua, who worked cattle with him on the island's biggest ranch, were considered nothing more than oddities when they turned up in Wyoming with their brightly colored outfits, small spurs, leather chaps, braided lariats, and wide-brim hats adorned with wildflowers. The three Paniola were viewed with either suspicion or mocking amusement, but they were about to rock the rodeo world with horsemanship skills and speed never before seen outside of the islands.
Wow, that sounds fantastic. You know, somebody ought to make a movie out of that or something.
Absolutely. I'm telling you, Rich, this was a great story that any Western fan will enjoy. These guys are the traditional underdogs and just take the bull by the horn, so to speak.
Any other bookstore finds while you were experiencing the tropical breeze?
I did get a short list of used bookstores from our buddy Tom Simon over at Paperback Warrior podcast. He'd been on assignment in Hawaii for a couple of years when he was with the FBI.
You got to figure if anybody knows the location of great or little known bookstores, it would be Tom, or I guess the FBI.
I'm not sure the FBI would be too interested, but Tom, of course, always is. Tom had warned me ahead of time that the pickings would be slim, and he was absolutely right. There may be a total of 4 sources on the islands for used books, and 2 of them are hit-and-miss library sales, which weren't going on while I was there. I ducked into the couple of actual used bookstores, but they had little or nothing when it came to Western paperbacks or anything else I might be interested in.
So the islands were great, but the bookstores were a bust.
That's the good news, bad news situation, but we had a great time anyway. I mean, who wouldn't? And my Kindle was loaded up, so I didn't lack for things to read. Aloha Rodeo was the big find of the trip. How about you, Rich? Did you dig into anything fun, or were you too busy signing copies of the first 2 books in your new Hellbenders series?
Hey, Hellbenders is doing great in ebook, but those are hard to sign. However, I did want to talk about the release of our unique Six Gun Justice anthology. As far as we can tell, the first and only anthology to be published by a podcast. So the stories were commissioned last year for our Patreon subscriber group by special request to some of today's top Western fiction scribes. Top-tier members in our group received a short story each month as one of their rewards for throwing a little dough our way. Some tales were rare treasures previously published in an obscure venue somewhere, or even more fun, some of them were brand new original works just for our Patreon members. Award winner John Nesbitt, for example, sent in a crackling new story called Night Horse, which has proved to be a fan favorite, and in my opinion, it's one of his best short stories ever in his career. And he finished it and mailed it to me, like, within 24 hours, so it was just fresh off the computer screen.
Wow.
After we collected more than a year's worth of excellence and mailed those out to our Patreon subscribers, it seemed only natural to us that we should share the work in a collection. The book came out this month to good reviews and good word of mouth, and we're proud of the writing that's on display. It's available on Amazon for Kindle or paperback, and it features tales from Ben Bolden, Wayne D. Dundee, Steve Hawkinsmith, Vicki Rose writing as E.Z. Jackson, Bob Vardman writing as Jackson Lowery, Jeffrey J. Marriott, Mickey Milam writing as Vaughn McKee, John D. Nesbitt, Scott Dennis Parker, Cheryl Pearson, Michael R. Ritt, and Jackie Rogers. One of the things I found most enjoyable about the collection is its diversity. This book truly embodies the spirit of our podcast in that we cover almost every Western subgenre in this book of tales, with the possible exception of steampunk. There are stories set in the halcyon days of the West and others in a contemporary time frame. There's humor, there's action, and there's romance. Paul, I think I can surely speak for both of us when I say it was a joy to ride with these writers on the trail.
Absolutely, and it's a great lineup of wanted writers, which is a great lead into our feature, Writing the Owl Hoot Trail with Jesse James.
Why don't you let loose those Hawaiian longhorns you brought back from your vacation as a souvenir?
Rich, I know you've got personal history with Jesse James, and I'm excited to hear you tell us about it, but perhaps we should start with some of the basic facts about Jesse James and his murderous career.
I agree, but first I want to point out that like several of our most recent subjects, such as Custer and Buffalo Bill, Jesse James is so much larger than life, it's again going to take a 2-part episode to cover everything we want to talk about. Here in part 1, we're going to do as you suggest and put the legend of Jesse James into its historic context, and we're going to add on a few anecdotes of our own. Why don't you get us up and galloping, Paul?
Sure. Jesse was born in Clay County, Missouri on September 5, 1847. His parents, Zerelda and Robert James, were hemp farmers who owned six slaves. Robert James was also a Baptist minister who assisted in founding William Jewell College in Liberty, Missouri. In 1850, he traveled to California to preach in the gold mining camps, but not long after arriving, he became sick and died, plunging Zerelda and her children, Jesse and his brother and future partner in crime Frank, and his younger sister Susan, into perilous financial straits. In 1852, Zerelda remarried to a wealthy older man and moved in with him, but he disliked the James children, so they were made to go and live with another family. Zerelda soon left the marriage and returned to her first husband's farm with her children. When she wed for a third time in 1855, her husband, with whom she would have four more children, also moved to the farm. After Frank and Jesse grew up to become outlaws, Zerelda, who was known as this iron-willed individual, remained their staunchest supporter.
When the Civil War came, Jesse's older brother, Frank, was considered a hero when he went off to fight for the Confederate cause. In 1863, having joined up with a band of pro-Confederate guerrillas, Frank took part in a raid spearheaded by guerrilla leader William Quantrill on the abolitionist town of Lawrence, Kansas, during which some 200 men and boys were killed and numerous buildings were destroyed. In their search for Frank and the other raiders, the wrath of the Union militiamen descended on the James family farm. Jesse was ambushed and badly beaten, and his stepfather was hung upside down from a tree and tortured for information. This was arguably the first major turning point in Jesse's life, sparking the 16-year-old to strike back by following in Frank's footsteps and becoming a marauding bushwhacker. He and his brother joined another bloodthirsty guerrilla group, this one led by Bloody Bill Anderson.
Jesse, Frank, and those they rode with terrorized the Missouri countryside. The burning anger and bloodlust in Jesse sparked his full participation in multiple atrocities, including the notorious Centralia Massacre, in which at least 20 unarmed Union soldiers were forced from a train and executed by the guerrillas, who would then go on to slaughter more than 100 federal troops who were attempting to hunt them down. The guerrillas viciously mutilated many of their victims' corpses. These were all events that foreshadowed who Jesse James would become and his future actions.
When the war ended, most of the Confederate guerrillas were weary of the battle and more than willing to put down their weapons and return to civilian life. But for Jesse and Frank, there was no peace. The defeat of the Confederacy was a gnawing humiliation, and Lee's surrender felt like a betrayal. The mocking disenfranchisement of most ex-Confederates by the victorious radical Republicans made Jesse feel like a victim, feeding his personal hatred and intractability. In May of 1865, a month after Confederate General Robert E. Lee surrendered at Appomattox Courthouse, Jesse was shot in the chest during a skirmish with Union troops near Lexington, Missouri. After being nursed back to health by his cousin, Zerelda Z. Mims, whom he would wed in 1874 and have two children, Jesse eventually banded with his brother and other former Confederate guerrillas to continue to fight for the Confederacy by bringing hell down on those they saw as their oppressors.
The war against Northern aggression had become a personal war for Jesse, a war he would never stop fighting, or at least never stop using it as an excuse for his murderous actions. By not accepting the defeat of the secessionist cause, Jesse justified in his own mind unleashing his burning inner fury on banks, trains, and stagecoaches. Hiding behind the false face of a diehard Confederate patriot, Jesse created a narrative in which he presented himself as a modern Robin Hood, robbing from the radical Republicans and giving to the poor. And there were many sympathizers who bought into this facade.
In reality, the role of outlaw hero continuing to fight against the oppressive fist of the Union was simply a myth Jesse cloaked himself in to hide his darker psychology. He was a sociopath for whom murder was the simplest way to feed his compulsive craving for attention. He may or may not have enjoyed killing, but murder certainly never weighed on his conscience. On December 7, 1869, Jesse began his continuation of the war by attacking a bank in Gallatin, Missouri. Justifying the armed robbery by claiming the bank was run by the man who had killed, or in Jesse's estimation, murdered, Bloody Bill Anderson, Jesse and Frank rode in during daylight, deliberately shot an unarmed cashier, and rode away with nothing but worthless paper for all their efforts.
A posse pursued them, but the brothers pulled off a daring escape, later declaring they would never be taken alive. The inherent drama of the situation was not lost on the newspapers, who of course milked the incident for all it was worth. Jesse reveled in the attention, so much so he began designing his robberies to attract as many column inches of newsprint as possible. He even went as far as to leave behind newspaper clippings of his exploits at the scenes of his crimes, so he was sure to be given credit.
Never one to miss an opportunity, Jesse became friends with John Newman Edwards, an ex-Confederate soldier turned newspaper editor. Edwards conspired with Jesse to promote the former bushwhacker as a hero and defiant Southern patriot of the Reconstruction era, a noble Robin Hood who helped his fellow Missourians fight back against the constant trampling of Republican outrages. Letters written by Jesse and published by Edwards let Jesse have things both ways, simultaneously proclaiming his innocence for specific crimes while maintaining a threatening presence as an outlaw to all who opposed him. "We are not thieves," Jesse wrote in one letter. "We are bold robbers. I am proud of the name, for Alexander the Great was a bold robber, and Julius Caesar and Napoleon Bonaparte." This was the dawning of the false legend, as, while Jesse certainly stole from the rich, there was no evidence he ever actually gave any of his ill-gotten gains to the poor.
Apparently he didn't get the memo that that's what they were supposed to be doing. Jesse and his gang robbed banks, stagecoaches, and trains with near impunity throughout the early 1870s. Relying on Confederate sympathizers for help, they eluded authorities again and again. It's possible Jesse had begun to accept the hype he himself had created as gospel. His actions showed his belief that he was indomitable, untouchable, and an unstoppable force. But in September 1876, his overconfidence shattered disastrously during the daring attempt robbery of the First National Bank of Northfield, Minnesota, some 500 miles away from their normal stomping grounds. Along with him were his brother Frank, Cole Jim and Robert Younger, and three other associates.
The gang targeted the bank after learning Adelbert Ames, a former Union general, had recently moved to Northfield. Ames, along with his father-in-law, Benjamin Butler, also a former Union general and radical Republican politician, was rumored to have deposited $75,000 in the bank. Everything that could go wrong did go wrong. The citizens of Northfield had no tolerance for former rebels, especially those arrogant enough to think they could strike with impunity. When three members of the gang went inside and demanded the cashier open the safe, he refused, which totally screwed up what was supposed to be a lightning raid.
You know, you look at the guy and go, "What do you mean, no?" When the town folks heard what was going on, they came, and they were looking for blood. Unfortunately, the gang killed the recalcitrant teller and another passerby, but the town folks engaged in a shootout with members of the gang who were stationed on the street outside the bank. They killed two of them on the spot and wounded another.
The remaining members of the gang fled, but there was a determined posse hot on their trail. 2 weeks later, following a gunfight near Medalia, Minnesota, the Younger brothers were captured and another gang member killed. Jesse and Frank, who had split off from the Youngers before the Medalia gunfight, were still on the run, like the murderous cowards they were. However, to evade those still hunting them for the reward money, Jesse and Frank were forced to lay low for the next few years, living in Tennessee under assumed names.
Despite being forced into exile, Frank began to appreciate settling into a life without violence and the need to constantly be on alert for men wanting to shoot him down. Jesse, however, chafed restlessly. Unable to settle down with his wife Z and his son, he struggled to make ends meet with various money-making schemes, including the buying and selling of racehorses, but he found all of it personally demeaning, especially having to hide in the shadows to not have people know who he was and pay fealty to him.
Finally, in 1879, Jesse's unquenchable thirst for the spotlight and the bloodlust coursing through his brain drove him back on the Owl Hoot Trail. But in the 3 short years since the disastrous Northfield bank raid, the country had licked its wounds and moved on. Ex-Confederates had taken over Missouri's political reins and now needed the status to be quo. There was no longer space or need for the hero worship of an out-of-control psychotic killer, no matter how much he waved the Confederate flag as justification for his murderous actions.
Even Jesse's new gang were markedly different. None were ex-soldiers, and certainly none had any feelings for or belief in the lost cause of the Confederacy. Money was their only motivation, so much so that the offer of a $10,000 reward motivated one of the gang to turn Judas. Rather than dying in a hail of gunfire while robbing a bank or a train, the legendary Jesse James was brought down while dusting a picture on the wall of his rented home in St. Joseph, Missouri on April 3, 1882. His wife and two children were in another room at the time.
The man who shot Jesse in the back of the head was Bob Ford, a new recruit into Jesse's gang. Also in on the shooting was Bob's older brother, Charlie, also a member of Jesse's new gang. It was Bob Ford who, earlier in the year, had conspired with the governor of Missouri to kill Jesse in exchange for the reward money. After Bob and his brother Charlie told the police they had killed the infamous outlaw, they were arrested and convicted of murder. Their sentence was to be hanged until dead. However, the Missouri governor quickly pardoned them.
The public was transfixed by Jesse's murder, which Bob and Charlie Ford deemed an assassination, when they took a page from Buffalo Bill's playbook and began reenacting the event in a traveling roadshow. Bob Ford was himself shot to death in 1894 in a Creed, Colorado saloon, and Charlie committed suicide shortly afterward.
These were all really stable people, weren't they, Paul?
The best of the West.
Following James' passing, there was lingering speculation he'd faked his own death and someone else was buried in his grave. Over the years, several different men claimed to be Jesse James. In 1995, scientists seeking to resolve the question of who was buried in James' grave exhumed his supposed remains from Mount Olivet Cemetery in Kearney, Missouri. The remains had been transferred there in 1902 from the original burial site on the James family farm. After conducting DNA testing, the researchers concluded the exhumed remains were almost certainly those of the 19th century outlaw.
And therein lies the rub.
You mean the uncertainty of the conclusion that the exhumed remains were almost certainly those of the 19th century outlaw?
I certainly do, because everybody loves a conspiracy theory. And while Jesse James died with few allies, the myth of the outlaw Robin Hood did not die with him. In fact, it grew exponentially until it eventually crowded out the inconvenient truths of Jesse's murderous life.
Paul, you and I have conversations about this weird phenomenon related to the idolizing of true villains. Jesse James certainly wasn't the only one. Billy the Kid, who we will be doing an episode on soon, has certainly been portrayed as the misunderstood underdog. Heck, even Charles Manson created his own cult of hero worshippers.
My thought would be that those who identify and put these bad guys up on a pedestal are mostly disenfranchised individuals who are aggrieved, rightfully or wrongfully, at how life has treated them. They somehow feel everybody is against them, doesn't understand them, or is not bending over to fulfill their right to entitlement.
You're saying this makes them take the side of those outside the law?
I'm Sheriff Minutia, not Dr. Minutia from the local psych hospital. But there seems to be a type of low self-esteem that connects people to bad guys. In some ways, it's a rebellion against the norms of society that ignore them, or worse, denigrate them.
Like the women who want to marry convicted serial killers type of thing.
Well, everybody loves a bad boy, I guess, but we are talking very bad boys here. Now, before we go any further, Rich, you've had your own experiences with bad boy Jesse James. I want to hear all about them.
Paul, when I sat down to write out a few anecdotes about Jesse James and how I've crossed paths with him a couple times in my life, it wasn't long before I had a bullet list nearly as long as my legal pad. From grade school to as recently as a few weeks ago, I continue to run across Jesse's legacy, which is still relevant and eagerly shared by other people.
I guess in some ways it's not a surprise, living as you do in Missouri, the James Gang's home state.
Yeah, indeed, that's part of it. But I'm continuously astounded by the vast breadth of Jesse's career and the legends, myths, and stories concerning him and the gang. More than a century ago, in an era without automobiles, this guy was more well-traveled than some of my own relatives are today.
Which is part of the explanation for why every single Jesse James story leads directly to three more.
Absolutely, and I can give you an example. On any given weekend, Gina and I often end up in Jesse James country. So it was a few years ago when a local trek west to Sedalia took us to Robber's Cut, also called Jesse James Hill. It's a railroad cut just east of Otterville, Missouri, around 12 miles outside Sedalia. On July 7th, 1876, the James Gang mugged a night watchman, stole his lantern, and flagged down the eastbound night express train. The boys robbed the train safes and headed on north to Minnesota. This leads directly into the story of Dick Stapp of Granby, Missouri, who was in on the train robbery plot. When one of the robbers was caught and brought to trial, Stapp acted as a witness against him. Then, fearing for his own life after this betrayal of the gang, he quietly opened a saloon in Galena. One night, a man in dark clothes and blue goggles came into the bar with a pistol on a mission of peace to warn him out of the way. Supposedly, the gunny was none other than Jesse James himself, who told Stapp, "I want you to be out of the way when we give ourselves up to the authorities. If you are not, some of us will put you out of the way."
How cool is that? Any other unexpected run-ins during your weekend travels?
This past July, we visited the old Versailles Hotel in Versailles, Missouri, and we saw the evidence of Frank and Jesse's many stays there back in the 1870s. There are photos of the gang playing cards at a card table which is still in existence, and we saw Frank's autograph in the hotel ledger. Apparently, according to the stories, Jesse always refused to sign in. I've come across Jesse's authenticated autograph in eastern Missouri at Hannibal's Mark Twain Cave. And, of course, western Missouri's St. Joseph, with its dual claim to fame as the birthplace of the Pony Express and Jesse's hometown. In fact, one of our favorite antique stores is called the Jesse James Mall.
It's amazing how these people get lauded. And yet, as we've expressed over and over again, they were murderous individuals.
Right.
So what was your earliest encounter with Jesse?
I grew up outside Bloomfield, a small community in northeast Nebraska, 300 miles from Jesse's birthplace. Founded in 1890, Bloomfield celebrated its Diamond Jubilee in 1965. They published a square-bound book of photos and remembrances of those 75 years, and inside was a photograph purported to be one of the founders of Bloomfield standing next to Jesse James.
Jesse James, in northeast Nebraska, after 1890. Hadn't he been dead for almost 10 years by then?
According to official records, maybe, but the photo was supposedly snapped sometime in the 1870s in a place called Devil's Nest, which isn't far from Bloomfield. I grew up a few miles from the Santee Sioux Indian Reservation and Devil's Nest. It's a rugged hill country of lush grasslands, deep canyons and ravines, grand vistas, and hidden twisty trails. It's the perfect outlaw retreat, and take my word for it, it's the perfect place for a bunch of high school guys to have fireworks wars.
You were an outlaw yourself, right?
We were. My friends and I often heard stories up there about Jesse and Frank James holing up in Devil's Nest, and some local families knew about Joe Jesse Chase, a man who claimed to be Jesse's son. In fact, I knew folks who had talked with him firsthand, and they kind of thought his story might be credible. Joe Chase died in 1940. Here's the story in a nutshell, taken from William A. Settle Jr.'s book, Jesse James Was His Name, or Fact and Fiction Concerning the Careers of the Notorious James Brothers of Missouri, originally published by University of Missouri Press in 1966. The copy I have is the seventh printing done in 1992, where on page 167, Settle recounts the following tale. In 1939, it was claimed that there had long been a legend in the Devil's Nest country of northern Nebraska that in 1869, Frank and Jesse James came to that area and established a trading post among the Indians. There, under the names of Frank and Jesse Chase, they met and married two beautiful Indian sisters, the daughters of Thomas Wabasha. In 1870, Jesse's Indian wife bore him a son named Joe Jesse Chase, and Frank became the father of a daughter, Emma. On July 4, 1870, Frank and Jesse had a dispute with a French trader, killed him, and left for parts unknown. They wrote their wives, but the women's mother would not let them reply. Jesse's wife later married William Goodteacher, and Frank's wife went to Minnesota and was never heard of again. Emma and Joe Jesse were reared as brother and sister in the Goodteacher home. In 1939, Joe Jesse Chase told the story as he had heard it from his mother.
So there's a chance the guy might have been legit.
I'd say there's a fair chance, sure.
Yeah, but what about the photo in Bloomfield's Diamond Jubilee book?
I've actually shared that photo around the Western community a time or two, and most of my friends, including author James Reisner, doubt that the man in the picture is Jesse. But I think it goes to show how much Jesse's legend captures the imagination of everyday folks that they would put that in the Diamond Jubilee book just to celebrate the history of the town. We all want that connection to a larger-than-life legendary figure.
There's the clanging of the chuck wagon triangle, partner, telling us to wrap up part one of our Jesse James episode with our shootouts and shoutouts.
Thanks to Mike Bray and Wolfpack Publishing for being our premier sponsor. Thanks also to our other sponsors, author Chris Enns and the Western Writers of America. Thanks to Roundup Magazine and Saddlebag Dispatches for their support in promoting our podcast.
If you are enjoying the podcast, please consider making a small monthly or one-time donation using the button at the top of our website to help us keep moseying along. Donations are appreciated, but clearly not expected or necessary. We're grateful for all our listeners and truly happy to have you sharing this trail ride with us.
Next Monday, Paul will be hosting a Six Gun Justice Speed Listen featuring everything you need to know about cowboys and dinosaurs, all in under 15 minutes, give or take.
And in 2 weeks, we will be back with part two of our take on Jesse James in episode 44 of the Six Gun Justice podcast.
And don't forget to visit Amazon.com and pick up a copy of our Six Gun Justice podcast Western Fiction Anthology. If you enjoy what you read, please do leave a good review for these guys and gals who work hard every day crafting the true spirit of the Western genre.
Until we meet again, be kind to each other, be kind to yourself, and keep your surfboards out of the corral.
Adios for now.
We're out of here. Let's ride.